We started with Professor Sterley, and we're going to finish with Professor Sterley. He's going to now talk to us about the potential to disrupt maritime commerce test, which is a little more complex than I originally thought it was.
I've been spending too much time sitting today, so I'm going to stand for this. As I said this morning during the recent developments discussion, it used to be that the three most important factors for admiralty tort jurisdiction were location, location, and location, just like real estate. But now, after Executive Jet, and more recently after Grubart, we have a three-part test, sometimes described as a two-part test, but there are two parts to the second part, so it comes to three parts. Location is still important. That's still the first factor. The second factor is whether or not the general type of incident involved in the case has a potentially disruptive impact on maritime commerce, the potential to disrupt maritime commerce test. And then the third requirement is whether or not the tortfeasor's activities bears a substantial relationship to traditional maritime activity, the significant relation to traditional maritime activity test. For the next half hour or so, I'm going to talk about the second of those, the potential to disrupt maritime commerce test. Now, at this conference 20 years ago, David Robertson and I described the potential to disrupt maritime commerce test as, quote, famously easy to satisfy. we said at the time, actually a couple of years earlier in another article, we had described the potential to disrupt maritime commerce test as accomplishing nothing as an independent doctrinal requirement. We said we have not found, nor can we plausibly imagine, a case that satisfies the significant relation to traditional maritime activity requirement, but fails under the potential to disrupt maritime commerce test. So adds nothing to say that potential to disrupt maritime commerce is a separate test. Well, it turns out we didn't have as much imagination as some courts have had. And in the last decade or so, we've seen a number of courts throw out cases saying, no, this did not have the, this incident did not have the potential to disrupt maritime commerce. And over the years in the recent developments papers, we have criticized a number of those. Louisiana crawfish producers and Petrobras America versus Vicine Cadenas S.A. were two of the cases that we criticized, both of which the Fifth Circuit basically ignored all of the maritime features in order to say there was no potential to disrupt maritime commerce. What I want to suggest is that it might be appropriate to go back and look at what the Supreme Court intended in creating the potential to disrupt maritime commerce test. And I think if the courts were truer to that, we would find that it doesn't, it's not a test that accomplishes much, that if there is a significant relation to traditional maritime activity, that will almost inevitably imply that there's also a potential to disrupt maritime commerce. Indeed, if we look at the evolution, we see that they weren't even originally two separate tests. It was only in the Sisson case where, as David explained it, Justice Marshall's clerks this year didn't understand what Justice Marshall's clerks had done 10 years before and foremost. But I'll go through that step by step. So before 1972, it was location, location, location. There had been some judicial, some scholarly criticism suggesting maybe there ought to be some relationship to traditional maritime activity as well. You know, Judge Benedict in the first edition of Benedict on Admiralty way back in 1850 had his famous doubt whether or not the location test alone was enough. Well, an Executive Jet, the Supreme Court was persuaded by that, said, yes, we have to have some kind of significant relation to traditional maritime activity in order to have admiralty jurisdiction. And they explained that we want to get rid of the occasional odd case where, two swimmers collide with each other and try to bring it in admiralty court.